Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture. Brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
I'm Daryl Bach, Executive Director for Cultural Engagement at the Hendricks Center, and you're here at the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture. And our topic today is the military chaplaincy. Well, it's the military chaplaincy, and it's also about movies, if you can put those two things together. My guest is Justin Roberts, who graduated from the Media Arts Program here at Dallas Theological Seminary. Welcome, Justin.
Thank you.
Justin is a military chaplain who is stationed in Germany. In fact, he's going to go from this taping directly onto a plane and back to Germany. So we hope he gets lots of rest tonight. And but he also is responsible for helping to publicize a movie called The Hornet's Nest that will be out in DVD shortly, and that is about the military experience. And so we thought we'd have Justin in to talk about the military chaplaincy, about the military and Christians in the military, and kind of the mix that that represents, and let him share a little bit about that experience as a part of the kind of ministry that that our grads sometimes fall into as their calling. So, Justin, tell us a little bit about yourself. First, a little bit about your training for both the military and for theology. Most people don't put those two together quite so easily. And then how you ended up being connected to the film.
It's funny because I know so many chaplains who play guitar. Uh-huh. And so they have that skill set. Uh-huh. And I have no musical talent. I can't even clap and sing at the same time.
Okay.
But I love photography. Mm-hmm. And I love film and I love writing. And so when I got to DTS, I wasn't even aware when I first came here that they had a media arts program. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even tracking at the mm-hmm. time. And so when I got here, I discovered that. And I was like, that's exactly what I want to do. Mm. You know, so I got a master's in biblical studies and a master's in media arts and communication. But I was still on track to go into the chaplaincy. Mm-hmm. And so I took those loves with me still. And when I got into the Army, I continued doing photography and started studying cinematography, and also continued to work on writing. And that when we deployed, I just talked to my command team and asked, hey, is it okay if I carry a camera? Hmm. And so that's what's kind of spiraled into this. You know, I had what led me out onto the missions, you know, actually going to the patrols and stuff, I had a really good first sergeant mm-hmm. who was a mentor of mine. Mm-hmm. And I asked him before I deployed, I was like, how should I do this ministry? Because I'd never done it before. I was a very green chaplain. Uh-huh. I literally showed up to my first training exercise with my helmet cover on backwards.
Okay.
So they mentored me, and I needed that. And so God does provide, you know. And so he told me, when I asked him, he was like, the number one thing you need to do, you need to go out on the patrols with the guys. You need to be near the front during major operations so that way you can pray, do your chaplain stuff. You know, pray over the guys when they're wounded and pray over the guys if they're dying. And so I made that my mission to go on those patrols to connect. Hmm. And it does work. Hmm. You know, if you're with people where they're hurting the most, that's when they begin to trust you. Mm-hmm. And so in the midst of that, I was still carrying my camera and just snapping away, just capturing some of the experience. And during Operation Strong Eagle 3, which was one of the largest operations, you know, or one of the largest battles in the war, mm-hmm. We landed into a valley that had roughly 400 Taliban fighters, and we had about 400 too. Mm-hmm. And so it was a pretty bad firefight. Mm. And so during that time, there was a reporter named Mike Betcher, mm-hmm. who's America's longest working war correspondent. Mm-hmm. Well, we met. I had some footage, and he had some footage. I asked my command team if I could lend him the footage mm-hmm. for his news piece. Mm-hmm. Well, he put together a news story for Nightline that was a Memorial Day special, mm-hmm. and that wound up winning 2 Emmys. Mm. And once it won 2 Emmys, started doing talks with Hollywood, and that's how it spiraled into The Hornet's Nest. Mm-hmm. So some of my footage is in that film, and I'm a co-executive producer on it.
I see.
Yes.
Now your training here was primarily in the area of writing, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and so you've kind of transferred now into doing, so I take it you're both writing and filming now?
Yes, sir.
That's great.
Put them together and you're pretty much directing.
There you go. So, very good.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about military in chaplaincy. You know, for some people wrestle with that combination in one way or another.
Yeah.
Many people perceive, and rightfully so, wrestle with the fact, you know, that Jesus talks about blessed are the peacemakers and that kind of thing. And there's almost a, if not a, a pacifist orientation, a pacifist leaning in some elements of the New Testament. So how do you put that together in terms of being a military person who's a Christian, who's there to minister and serve? How do you put that together?
I definitely don't want to speak on behalf of all theology or all chaplains on this one. Yeah, I mean, as far as me personally, it never struck up an issue with me. I mean, because my number one goal is to take care of my soldiers and to minister to them. Mm-hmm. And then if anybody else comes into my circle, like with the Afghans, then absolutely to care for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's where I stand, and I of course I do. I'm serving guys who are warriors, who are bringing war you know, upon others. And so then we start getting into just war theory.
That's right.
That's
exactly. Well, some people don't even know about just war theory.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done pieces myself when the Iran war broke out with Iraq, rather. I did a piece for the Dallas Morning News that discussed just war in relationship to pacifism, because people know I do a lot of writing about Jesus. So,
yes.
So some people aren't aware of the distinction between individual ethics, if you will, and the right of the state to defend its people and to have a military and that kind of thing. So that's in some ways what I was alluding to.
Yeah.
And so the point being that the chaplaincy is there because this is military obviously is a high stress situation in which people are risking life and limb. There's a lot of trauma that goes into being in the military. There are terrific responsibilities. There's separation from home. There's just a lot at a personal level to deal with if you're in the military.
Yes.
And so the idea of a minister coming alongside who has some both theological and counseling background that can help with someone in that situation makes sense to have. And so that's what chaplains do, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is something too, like the workload is always a heavy workload. And just by that, I think it proves its need.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's I'll do 3 or 4 counselings a day, you know, and it's going to be divorces, it's going to be you know, depression, PTS, you know, a litany of issues that are bubbling up through the under the surface, and these are people who, you know, a lot of the people who've been through combat who've been traumatized, and so that is our job, is just to walk with them as pastors and care for them, you know, to care for the broken, and so that's our role. It's as far as, like, you know, the day-to-day functions. I mean,
I was
going to
ask you about
sermons.
I was going to ask you about that next. What does a chaplain do? What's the well? I mean, Sundays might be transparent as to what might happen on a Sunday, but why don't you take us through a normal week and then come to Sunday? What does a chaplain do?
Oh, I don't know if I've ever had a normal week. I mean, because it really is. I'm an emergency responder a lot of times too, and so when I get 3 a.m. calls that, you know, somebody's having a suicidal ideation, I'm going to respond to that. And so, you know, I'm given average chaplains are going to have around 800 people to care for, you know, their battalion. And so they are going to meet whatever that need is, you know, as pastors. And so it's going to be a lot of counseling. I think that's the bread and butter of the job. But it's also working as a staff officer for the commander. You know, we're going to report to him, you know, as far as the health and, you know, morale of the unit. How are the guys doing? What are the trends? And how can the unit try to help meet those needs? And then somehow you fit in your Sunday service, you know, working on the sermon. I always kind of just joke around. It seems like, you know, other pastors will have about 10 hours or so to kind of work on their sermon, and we'll have two.
Yeah.
So I hope it's good quality.
So there's a lot of pastoral care. There are so many questions that are lined up here. I'm not sure which one to deal with. Let me deal with one that might not be transparent to most people, but that they might think about once I ask it, and that is, You know, we talk about in our Constitution that there's a separation of church and state, and mm-hmm. yet there the tradition of a chaplaincy goes way, way back.
Yeah.
So obviously there's no constitutional challenge to chaplains existing with the Army because of the historic association that's existed.
It's also their rights. Mm-hmm. You know, first off, the first two people that Washington appointed mm-hmm. In the military was mm-hmm. first the infantry. Mm-hmm. The second was the chaplain. Like, okay, we got all these rowdy guys. Uh-huh. Let's get somebody for these rowdy guys.
So it goes way, way back. Yeah, and Washington is very famous for having given in a farewell speech, made the observation that religion is really the pillar of the stability of a society. And so,
yes.
So he was very much committed to the presence of religion without endorsing any particular
yes.
strain of faith. And that's how the chaplaincy is run. Am I
and
right?
It's a natural part of the fabric of society.
Uh-huh.
And it's something that's never going to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we ebb and flow throughout time, you know, as far as religious positions are concerned, but religion is always going to be present.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as people's constitutional rights, soldiers, all military has Title X rights.
Mm-hmm.
They have the right to practice their faith.
Mm-hmm.
And the providers of those faiths are chaplains
mm-hmm.
of, you know, Protestant, Catholic, you know, Buddhist, Muslim, Jewish,
mm-hmm.
all of these faiths. And when we're in a war zone, we still have the right to practice those faiths.
Mm-hmm.
And those faiths need leaders,
mm-hmm.
guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the chaplain corps brings to the table.
Mm-hmm. And so the chaplaincy is made up of people of all kinds of faiths. And,
yes.
And so it's diverse like our society is.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we've covered the legal ground now.
it's a constitutional right that we're exercising on uh-huh. their behalf.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not proselytizing. It's just providing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that explains the rationale of the chaplaincy. You've talked a little bit about what you do, that you do a lot of counseling. You've talked a little bit about suicide. You've brought up that element. I take it that the military wrestles with, because of the traumatic situation in which soldiers find themselves, that there are probably at least two or three key issues that come up regularly. One is wrestling with maintaining, for those who are married, maintaining their marriages while
yes.
they're away and oftentimes completely separated from their family and the dynamics that means, not only while they're away, but also there are dynamics when they return and the unit comes back
yeah.
together and the adjustments that have been made. I know of many stories I've heard among military that, you know, that they're married, they go away, their wife has been running everything at home for a long time, they come back and there's that readjustment and she now understands how the home works in many cases. And so
better than he does.
That's right. So and sometimes have borne this responsibility for a very long period of time because they can be time in service away can last for a long time. So there's that. There's just the pressure and the trauma of facing battle,
yeah.
if I can say. And then there's the trauma of having gone through battle, if I can
yes.
say it that way. And so you mentioned suicide ideation, and I know the military wrestles with and keeps its eye on caring for veterans in light of the trauma that they're put through. Let's talk about that a little bit from the chaplain side. Is that the major area of counseling, or a major area of counseling that you have? Is the trauma related to battle, or is it all over the map?
It's all over the map. I mean, because it also depends on what's currently going on in the unit. So as we gear up to deploy, then counseling shift into, you know, pre-deployment issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the stresses of, you know, leaving the family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the stresses for the family of, you know, losing their soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the deployment, there's going to be a litany. It could be trauma issues. It could be depression issues. It could be just the anxiety of war.
Mm-hmm.
And then as they come home, you know, that transition too, like marital problems and issues. Parenting issues, mm-hmm. you know, how do I take on that new role again?
Mm-hmm.
The financial issues,
uh-huh.
And depression and sleep issues. It's You know, it's hard not to be broken, you know, when you're going through war.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to always be fractures.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gets through it completely just normal. You're going to be changed by it.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that you have to be negatively changed, but you are going to be changed. There's going to be a transformation. And that's not just for the soldiers. That's also for their spouses and their families. Mm-hmm. They're going to go through a transformation as well. And so it's just trying to guide that, mm-hmm. you know, towards a positive direction, towards mm-hmm. strengthening, mm-hmm. you know, more resiliency.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we try to walk alongside them in the midst of that. So I wish there was definite trends that we could target.
Yeah.
So, a target to shoot at.
But. Yeah. So when you minister, you're ministering to the soldier and to the family.
Yes.
You end up, so when you talk about dealing with family transitions, you're talking about both dealing with the husband and the wife and the children.
And the kiddos.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. So you were in Afghanistan for a while? For
yes,
how
sir.
Long?
From 2010 to 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And so for 12 months.
Mm-hmm. Now, are most deployments, are they a year long? Are they 6 months long? Or how long is it, or does that vary?
It depends on the branch. Army is usually 12 months, but I think they have now geared it towards 9-month deployments.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and we're starting to wind down, which
mm-hmm.
is good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, so someone runs the house at home, and they've been and the husband, in effect, or the wife has been away for anywhere from 9 months to a year.
Yeah.
They drop back in. Kids are a little more grown up, and everything's changed. And so, all the marital dynamics that you had before you left have been altered.
Yeah.
As my wife and I like to joke, when we change countries, we've lived in Germany 4 separate times for a year. It's like you're stationed in Germany. Say all the rules of how we manage our marriage in the United States change when we go to Germany.
Yeah.
Because things just operate in a different way, and different people are cultural. Accepts certain people doing certain things and less accepting of certain people doing certain things. And so all that adjustment happens. And the same thing happens within family dynamics too, I take it.
Yeah. Hopefully that they get enough contact, you know, during the year, but there's only so much that can be communicated through Skype,
mm-hmm.
you know, through a telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And so things do change. And the thing is one of the amazing things is in the process of it, if the communication is kept up and they keep reaching out and focusing on each other, then their marriage can be strengthened by it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whenever I went on the deployment,
mm-hmm.
I remember halfway through it, I was like, I am never going to take for granted,
mm-hmm.
you know, the time that I have with her,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the time that I have with my family.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something you're really aware of until it's taken from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can be a blessing in the midst of it. But it's different for everybody on how that transition happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Change is always difficult, I guess.
So we've talked about family and family dynamics and how mm-hmm. that works. You've mentioned two other things that I think are important. You've talked about depression, which is interesting, and then obviously the trauma of war. Let's go through those two. Depression. How's that? Is there a way in which that's peculiar in the context of the military, or? Would you say no? It's just that the nature of the pressure people are put under makes it more common.
I think it's just the nature of the stress that's, you know, everybody's being put on, you know, throughout a deployment that can pop up,
mm-hmm.
and I think it can pop up. I think fairly, you know, for a lot of people, especially if they've been through combat,
mm-hmm.
Because no matter what happens, I mean, the brain still has to process what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
This is a lot of new stuff that human beings just naturally do not
mm-hmm.
Cope with well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, usually, especially, you know, you're being shot at.
Mm-hmm.
You have a friend who's died,
mm-hmm.
you know, possibly close to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are traumatic things.
Mm-hmm.
And so how people process that when they get back, you know, is difficult, especially mm-hmm. if they're not working with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about it. They mm-hmm. don't know how to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something we encounter, you know, fairly often.
Mm-hmm.
And it's normal and it's okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously the trauma of war can be intense, and that's part of why suicide can sometimes be a problem in the military, because
yeah.
people have a lot of trouble sometimes processing what they see and what they've experienced.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to shift a little bit. I take it the Hornet's Nest is about a soldier's experience. Is that a fair way to say it?
Yeah. And so what Mike Betcher did is he's America's longest working war correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
And so for over 30 years, he's been doing this job. And just like soldiers, he'd go on his deployments mm-hmm. to report.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'd be away from his family again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And his son, because of that, Carlos, they just had a lot of separation.
Mm.
And so when Mike let him know that he was going to be going on this next deployment, you know, to cover the soldiers and Marines, his son asked if he could go.
Hmm.
And just so that way they could connect and have that time together.
Hmm.
And
how old was he at the time?
I think he's like mid-20s.
Okay.
And Mike Betcher is a little bit older.
Yeah.
But don't tell him I said that.
Okay.
So they spent that time, I'm not sure how long it was, but I know it was a good long time, stationed with the Marines in Helmand Province, one of the most dangerous places, and then up in Kunar Province, the other dangerous place.
Hmm.
So that's their story. Hmm. It's the story of a father and son, their relationship, and also the lessons that they learned from these soldiers in the midst of that place.
So it's the point of view is from the point of view of the reporter and his son.
Yes.
And the footage is footage that both you and he shot?
Yes, sir, and Carlos. And so I come in probably during the third act. You can see some of my footage there.
Okay. So Carlos is the son?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So and so you are giving people the feel of not just what reporting on war is about, but what the war experience itself is about for the soldiers. Is that
yes.
the – I mean, if someone goes to – you know, people are used to going and seeing war films that are either about something in the history in the past that's usually a made-up story or
yes.
somewhat made-up, as opposed to being a reflection of kind of the real experience. Would you consider this more a documentary or?
It is, but it's the way that it's cut is it's more like a feature film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not a slow documentary.
Yeah.
It's fast paced and it's, you know, bullets are flying and
mm-hmm.
And it's the hard stuff, but the stuff that I think we need to see as a country, we need to have this conversation
mm-hmm.
as the war is coming to a close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to begin discussing these things because this is a good segment of our population who has fought this war on our country's behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to understand it.
Okay. So there are multiple points I take it to the film. One is obviously to just the human story of this reporter and his son and how
yes,
they
sir.
Operate in this kind of an environment. The second is to give an appreciation, I take it, for what it is that someone who is in the military goes through by serving overseas and giving a glimpse of what that looks like. And it sounds like that part of it is to enhance people's appreciation for what the service in the military means, but to push it in a less abstract direction, if I can say it that way. We're talking about more than applauding for the serviceman who we see at the airport, which I've seen several times,
mm-hmm.
or allowing them to get on the plane first when the, when you're talking about in part a substantive societal response in appreciation for someone who's in the military who comes back because their sense of displacement, if I can use that word, when they come back, having processed going through a war and now trying to re-enter society, is actually one of the more difficult transitions that a military person can have. Is that
yes? And it's the thing is like I don't think it wraps itself in the flag.
Mm-hmm.
What I think it does is it just simply shares their stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like here's just simply these are guys, these are gals, they're just human beings. They have kids, they have families, and so understanding them past just being a number, a statistic,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a war zone or just a distant coverage, you know, from a newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
These are the human beings who are fighting this war. And
mm-hmm.
you can't really understand this war without understanding that these are people.
Hmm.
And so that's what this film is trying to do, is just to simply share their stories. And in the midst of it, you know, the reporter's story,
mm-hmm.
you know, his own experience of it and what he's experiencing, you know, what he's learning from it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're trying to push out.
And in this in the midst of doing that, I take it that part of the goal is to give people a really deeper appreciation for the level of sacrifice that's involved in serving in the military overseas. Would that be? I mean, I could ask you. You know, what's the mission of the film?
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. Well, and it's I. Through the stories, I mean, just naturally through the stories, whenever you hear them, it's not something that has to be fictionalized in any way or prompted or manipulated. It's just simply telling, you know, the story of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to know them,
mm-hmm.
I mean, these are my friends. I'm insanely impressed by these guys,
mm-hmm.
you know, and what they have been through and what they're striving for. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have several guys who were wounded whenever they were over there. And then chose to come back mm-hmm. to the unit.
Mm-hmm.
And they could have stayed home.
Mm-hmm.
They honestly could have.
Mm-hmm.
But they chose to come back to their guys because they love their guys.
Mm-hmm.
And if that doesn't impress you as a human being, I have no idea what will.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be manipulated. It doesn't have to be construed. It just, that is what happened.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, an evidence of love. It's an evidence of their true care for the people that they're fighting with. And that inspires me.
Uh-huh.
That pumps me up.
Uh-huh.
It makes me proud.
Thanks for listening to The Table Podcast. Join us next week for part two. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.